Part 3. Cultural Boundaries. So many guiding sayings follow us our every step. But are they wisdom or boundaries? Snippets of value to be heeded? Or the lesser ways of lost times, best forgotten or at the very least updated? So many times I find these traditions or ancient wisdoms or ways to be the latter. The very notion of the wisdom of the day seems malleable after all. And if we are to be tied to the ways of our ancestors, then how can we hope to improve upon that which they have left us? Are ritual and tradition so very different from physical structures? Would the dwarves stop mining when they reached the boundaries of the tunnels in their ancient homelands? Of course they would not. They would dig new tunnels. And if in that work they were to discover better materials or designs for their scaffolding, they would use them, and likely would go back to the older tunnels and better the work left behind by their fathers, 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 fathers. Why then would this be different in matters of tradition? Certainly, among my own people, traditions are limiting, terribly so. Half the population of Menzo Berenzon is trapped into lesser roles, their ambitions caged by words older than the oldest dark elves, words inscribed millennia past. Part of the reason in this case is obvious. Lady Loth and her decrees. Indeed, religion to those of the faith, any faith, is often unbending and not subject to the scrutiny of reason or to pleas against simple injustice. The word is eternal, it is claimed. And yet, on many occasions, it is obvious that it is not. Why then do these so-called wisdoms hold on so tightly? The whims of an unavailable and conveniently unassailable deity are only part of the answer, I believe. The other part goes to the darker corner of the ways of every reasoning race. For those traditions kept past all plausible rationales or obvious moral failings, those held most fervently, too often serve those who gain the most by keeping them. In the city of my birth, those in power do not have to compete with half the population. The matrons need not worry about a patron, surely, and indeed, by tradition, can use their male counterparts as they please. Even those acts as personal as lovemaking are determined by the demands of the women of Menzo Berenzon, and let there be little illusion about the love in such an act. And a man who will not comply could face harsh retribution for his insolence. Only women can serve as the head of a house. Only women can sit on the ruling council, and even the highest-ranking man in the city, typically the archmage of Menzo Berenzon, is by tradition, by edict, by the demands of those merciless rulers, still counted more lowly than the lowest-ranking woman. The drow are not the only people cornered and held fast by such systemic indecencies. Far from it. In Wulfgar's tribe and throughout many of the peoples all about the north, tradition demands patriarchy instead of matriarchy. And while the men are not as brutal in their control as the drow women, the result, I expect, isn't much different. Perhaps the treatment is softer. I recall Wulfgar's shame, so profound that it led him to run away from us when, in a fit of demon-induced memories, he struck Catti Bree. I could never imagine Wulfgar beating a woman intentionally or demanding sexual pleasures from her against her will. But even in his contrition, there remained inside him for many years that soft condescension. He must protect the women, he thought, which might be a noble undertaking, except that it came with an unspoken but surely evident belief that they were not capable of protecting themselves. He placed them on a pedestal, but as if they were fragile things. He simply could not bring himself to understand the true competence of a woman, even one as powerful, intelligent, capable, and proven as Catti Bree. It took him years to brush it aside and fully recognize the value, the equal worth and potential of Catti Bree and of all women. So ingrained were the teachings of his earliest years that even when he was faced with so much clear and convincing evidence of the error of his ways, it took a great effort on his part to free himself. Yes, to free himself. For that is what it is to fully accept that that which you have been taught so thoroughly, the designs of the entire society around you, might be in error. Wolfgar let go of the nonsensical sexism of his people, and the greatest beneficiary of that dismissal was, in fact, Wolfgar himself. Dare I hope the same from Ivanel? For this is Jarlaxle's hope, I know, and his quest, and one in which he continues to use me as his shining example. I can only laugh, and can only hope that the powerful matrons of Menzo Berenzon don't grow so tired of Jarlaxle's games that they come and kill me to take from him his preeminent symbol. There are people all about free of such sexism, of course, but they too are chained by their ways. In the Delzoon dwarf tradition, the gender of a dwarf is unimportant against the weight of merit. There is in Mithril Hall now a queen, Dagnabit, daughter of Dagnabit, son of Dagna. It matters not. Her rule will be judged by her actions alone. In every aspect of dwarven life, from combat to cooking to mining to ruling and everything in between, merit and competence are all that matter. If the person in question is a dwarf. I cannot complain, far from it, of the treatment I have received from the dwarves in my many decades on the surface. But that was more the matter of Brunner's personal compassion, for he is a true credit to his people. A friend is a friend, and an enemy is an enemy. And not the size of one's ears, the color of her skin, or the height he stands, makes a lick of spit difference to King Brunner Battlehammer. Were it not for him, though, the dwarves of Icewind Dale would not likely have ever accepted a lost and wandering dark elf into their homes as kin. Unless there was another like Brunner, who first happened upon me on the slopes of Kelvin's Cairn. I cannot dismiss that possibility. For within every people, every culture, there exists the rainbow span of qualities, prejudices, compassion, kindness, and cruelty. It is an absurd belief of the humans that the drow are simply evil. Oh, many drow have earned that reputation, to be sure, but so have many humans. They make war on each other as commonly as drow houses battle in the shadows, and on a scale so great that one battle might leave more broken victims, including those who have no part in the fight, than exist in the entire city of Menzo Berenzon. I have witnessed Prisoner's Carnival, where the magistrates torture fellow humans with as much skill and glee as any whip-wielding priestess of Loth. I have seen the elves of the surface turn refugees away from their shelter, leaving them to the mercy of those pursuing them. Even the often carefree halflings are not exempt from the darker shades of the heart. Yet for all of this, I remain confident of a better tomorrow. Brunner and the other dwarven kings and queens do not hold their people clenched within as tight a fist as their predecessors did. Regis and Dinala do not rule bleeding vines. No, they are called the lord and lady of the village, but they are more the overseers of the business of the place. And amazingly, they serve at the sufferance of their villagers. For Dinala has changed the tradition of the Topolino clan. And now the people of Bleeding Vines have been given a great gift. Their voice. Because that's what tradition does. It robs an individual of their voice. It eschews the solo and focuses solely on the chorus. And woe betide the singer who goes against the conductor. No. Bleeding Vines is more of an orchestra, each instrument having its say, but playing in harmony, creating a whole. If the people there choose others to lead, then Dinala and Regis will step aside. This is the tomorrow I hope for. Because I believe only in a culture where the demands of all the people are heard can the needs of the people be met. This is the sound of tomorrow. And so tomorrow will be better than today. Drizzt Do'Urden.